Wait a minute, Doc. Are you telling me that you built a time machine? Out of a DeLorean?
The way I see it, if you're gonna build a time machine into a car, why not do it with some style? Besides, the stainless steel construction made the flux dispersal. Look out!
That was one of the coolest things I've done is, you know, going around these forests deep in the heart of Central America where, you know, no one speaks English, no one looks like me, and actually being taken to these areas.
Oh, that sounds freaking cool.
The indigenous people were like, oh, I don't know why you guys like this, but if you want to know where they are.
Hey guys, we'll get into the podcast in just a minute. However, I am looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show, and I am planning a road trip across America and including parts of Canada. I'll tell you more about both of these at the end of this podcast. Hey everyone, welcome to the Blue Collar Voices show. Today we have Nathan Brown. Nathan Brown founded Old World Timber. It's a company that sources reclaimed lumber from various locations around the world and, of course, from the United States. I ran across Nathan on LinkedIn, connected, and I'd see his posts from time to time. After I started the Blue Collar Voices show, I reached out to Nathan, asking him to be a guest on the show to talk about his business, his journey, kind of find out his origin story and, you know, what makes him tick. Nathan, welcome to the Blue Collar Voices show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, John. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it as well. I love talking to people, and this is like brain candy for me. So let's go ahead and, in brief, let's summarize what it is that Old World Timber does.
Yeah, so Old World Timber, we source material, reclaimed wood from various parts of the world, primarily the United States. Although we're also starting to do quite a bit of sustainably sourced new timber as well. And we manufacture it into different products such as flooring, wall and ceiling accents, furniture, surfboard tables, you name it. We just kind of are, I tell people sometimes we're in the fashion industry that happens to be wood. So.
Okay. You said something about new lumber as well.
Yeah, so we're people sometimes ask me, well, what if reclaim goes out of style? And I counter that question with, well, paint doesn't go out of style. Just the colors of paint go out of style, right? And so the same is true with wood. And so when people are looking for a, you know, cleaner modern aesthetic or all the way to a rustic aesthetic, we can pretty much hit whatever look you're shooting for. And sometimes increasingly that is new lumber.
Okay. I had made a list of questions to talk about. That kind of touches on one of them, which is, but is the reclaimed wood different than the wood you can buy that's harvested today? And more or less, if so, how?
Yeah, it's a good question. A lot of the wood that we do use doesn't really exist in the natural world today. And if it does, it's typically protected, you know, in some of our national forests and things like that. So a lot of the timber that we deal with, the reclaimed wood that we deal with, that is wood that sometimes we even say our wood doesn't grow on trees because it, you know, you can't get that wood anymore. The trees that people were using 100 or 150 years ago in our country to build, you know, houses or buildings or barns, whatever the case may be, that those trees that existed back then, a lot of times we're the first tree to ever grow in the forest. So sometimes it's referred to as virgin growth or original growth. And the growth rings are so incredibly dense because that tree had to fight for sunlight and water along with all the other trees that were growing up in the canopy simultaneously. So it's harder, denser, and those trees were much larger than what we see today. So in many regards, it's pretty unique. We also, most of the timber we use that was reclaimed from some other source has different characteristics from what Mother Nature did to it over the last 100 or 150 years that give it a very unique aesthetic that's kind of impossible to replicate.
So it sounds like you're saying that the trees grew, They were really large, so there was a lot of wood, so you could have big pieces. But they actually grew slower than our production trees do nowadays. Since it was doing the fighting, it wasn't able to expand each year as much as our current production trees could do, and that's what gave it its increased density.
That's correct, and the growth rings are very, very tight because the tree didn't grow much year to year. You know, it had to struggle, and the growth rings and newer timber, they're much looser grain because for that very reason.
So if you went into a virgin forest today, we'll call it virgin, just say something that where the trees, natural growth, it's been a couple hundred years, hasn't been touched, that lumber is still going to have those same characteristics.
That's correct. And a lot of these trees that were harvested 150 years ago, that tree might have been 200, 300, 400, 500, 600, 800 years old when they harvested it.
Okay.
And the trees you just referenced would also be in that category.
Okay. I didn't understand about the ring growth, and I can see how that might, I mean, I see how that works, your explanation, that the trees today, that we give them plenty of sunlight, and they grow quickly, but we harvest them, what, after like 20, 25 years?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of varies depending on species and the use for that timber, but yeah, 20, 30, 40 years is kind of what the normal, I mean, I'm not a new timber expert by any stretch of the imagination, but based on what I know, it's, yeah, 20, 30, 40 years is what the trees are harvested in.
So thinking about flooring, if you want a floor that's going to be more durable and really last, you're going to want that denser ring pattern just for the hardiness of it.
Yeah, so a lot of the, you know, the floors that we make are typically wider and longer because the wood that we're starting with is wider and longer. And then the new flooring or new paneling a lot of times is, you know, they're much shorter lengths and the density is not nearly what we're currently using with the reclaimed either.
Okay. Well, that's good information, and it explains additionally to me why reclaimed lumber has so much value. I recognize the fact that it's just freaking cool that you've taken something that used to exist in, say, a mill or wherever it might be, a barn, and you're turning it into something new and being able to capture that essence and saying, yeah, this came out of a barn that was built in, you know, 1793 or something, and now you've got stuff made out of it. That's pretty cool. But the quality of, you're talking about the material, you're wanting to put in a new floor in your home and you want something that's just super amazing, you go get that hardwood. It's got the dense rings. That floor is going to last a long time, which now brings up the perfect time to talk about cost. So if I'm going to get a floor made out of reclaimed lumber, it's going to be a hardwood floor. How does that compare with today's flooring if I'm going to go buy material made out of, you know, fresh production wood?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the reclaimed wood is definitely more more expensive, and that might be, you know, 20 to 50% more expensive. But then again, there are plenty of new flooring options that are very high end as well. So it really just depends. I mean, if you're looking to spend 99 cents a square foot, we're definitely not the place for you. But if you're looking for, you know, some kind of mid-range, you know, say $5 to $9 a square foot, mm-hmm. That's something that we, you know, we got you covered pretty much in a multitude of options. And the reason I think I should add that reclaimed wood is more expensive is not only does it have to be harvested from a salvage demolition site, whether it's a barn or old textile mill or old building, whatever the case may be, that wood typically, probably 99% of the time, has metal in it, different nails and whatnot. And the process for removing the metal, the denailing and the metal detecting is very arduous. And that is something that's very labor intensive as well, which obviously increases the cost to get that lumber to a state where you can actually run it through a production line.
Do you just use like handheld scanners, or do you have what kind of equipment do you use to detect from metal?
Yeah. So the crazy part is there's really no other way to get the metal out other than, you know, just hammers, nails. We have a reverse nail gun But if the metal is embedded into the wood, there's just no way to get it out other than go digging for it. And there's no machine that can do that. And so that's one of those things that it will probably always be a niche market, because the major huge production mills, they're not even going to consider running this kind of timber through their production lines, just because their equipment's way too expensive.
And sure.
Way, you know, so yeah, that's one of the things that a lot of people don't think about when they think about reclaimed wood, is they don't realize that, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into preparing it even before you can turn it into a finished product.
So where did you get the idea, the genesis in your mind, to think about starting a business reclaiming wood?
So my background is sort of real estate and finance, and I started to do some real estate development, and the kind of 30-second version is we had to tear down this barn to put a road in where the cul-de-sac was going to go in the subdivision, and my friend and builder at the time said, hey man, we should take down this barn, and you should put, I was building a house to live in at the time as well, and we should take these big timbers and put them as exposed beams in your house.
I said, yes.
That sounds pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was it ended up being one of the coolest features of that house that I lived in for a number of years. And then when I decided to sell it, the first people that walked in to look at the house the day I listed it, they bought it. And anyways, but in the interim, while I was living there, I realized that there was it was very difficult to find consistent supply of reclaimed wood. And so when I was using it in different projects, it was tough to find. And so when it did become available, I would just kind of buy the lot. And so I started accumulating a bunch of this reclaimed wood. And my wife said, well, what are you doing? You have this warehouse full of wood. We don't even have a business. And I said, yeah, that's a good point. So I said, all right, well, I'm just going to sell it all. So I put it on Craigslist and eBay. You know, this was about 8 or 9 years ago. And I started getting contacted from people all over the country and even internationally saying, hey, you know, we'd like to buy this. And so I realized that there was a pretty big opportunity to be sort of the provider or the facilitator between the guys that are actually tearing the barns down and, you know, the architect in San Francisco or New York or New Zealand that's speccing this particular product for their project. And so, you know, one thing led to another. I was mostly doing wholesale when I first started, basically aggregating wood and then selling it without doing any processing. And that sort of evolved over the last 6 or 7 years and into a full-blown manufacturing plant. That's kind of the way I ended up doing what I'm doing.
And at that particular point in time, when you're doing the lumber, it was just you, or did you have anybody, maybe it's from some of your other projects, was helping you facilitate this?
Yeah, so I had a couple. I had one employee, and then a couple, and then two employees that were sort of working part time, and then eventually full time with the wood. And that started growing, and a lot of my customers were starting to say, "Hey, you know, rather than ship us a semi load of or a container of raw material, you know, would you be able to kiln dry it or process it?" And I was naive enough at the time to say, oh yeah, I can get into manufacturing. It can't be that hard. I'll just, you know, it's just wood, it's just planers and some whatever. It can't be that hard. And needless to say, it is much more complicated than that. My background was not manufacturing. So there were a couple years of pretty steep learning curves that, that I had to get through, but
wow.
Now I got a bunch of great guys that are much smarter, in that area than I am that are running the place. So.
Yeah. But I bet you loved that learning experience.
I think I loved it more so after the fact,
right?
during the journey was, sometimes challenging, but, definitely no substitute for experience, right? You just got to learn.
Looking at your background, you look like the kind of guy that's always looking for a challenge.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely am always looking to stay busy and find new challenges and opportunities to figure out new things. Sometimes I'm good at juggling, you know, 8 or 9 balls, but my tendency is to try to start juggling, you know, 10 or 12, and I need to stay in my lane and not constantly be pushing the envelope. So
you grow, delegate, grow some more.
Yeah. And I'm learning a lot about delegation, because you got to have a great team with people that are a lot better at their particular area than, than I am. And one of the things I'm getting pretty good at is knowing what I'm not good at, and I'm okay with it. So I'm just trying to stay in my lane and surround myself with people that are great at different things.
Sure. I know a lot of things about different things.
Right.
There's a whole lot more that I don't know. There's no way you can know everything. Just no freaking way. Even though I want to, I can't.
Not possible. Not possible.
How many different countries at this point in time have you actually got reclaimed wood from?
We have, man, I guess I should think about this. Central America, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, all over the United States, even Canada. Let's see, Europe, we've gotten Austria, Italy, Croatia, Serbia, France, and then in Africa, we have sourced wood from Northern Africa, Tunisia, and Algeria, and we're looking to start sourcing some reclaimed teak from Indonesia and Burma, and we're just trying to work through the hoops we got to jump through for that, but those are some of the ones. There's probably some other ones that I'm not remembering off the top of my head, but
sure.
But those are some of the areas that we're bringing wood in from.
Now, the hoops you talk about, is that like import restrictions?
Yeah, so kind of a funny story. In Burma, for example, or Myanmar, they have unfortunately been subjected to a lot of deforestation of their teak, their virgin, original growth teak trees. And so when we were started working with the government there to actually export reclaimed wood, they simply did not believe that that was actually what we wanted to do. I think they thought that we must have been trying to export drugs or something, because they were like, why would you want these trees? Like, why would you want what they perceive to be firewood? Actually, it's not even firewood. It's actually, teak is so oily that you can't really even burn it. So it doesn't rot. You can't burn it. And so a lot of times it's just actually sitting in these massive depots of just kind of wood, you know, from old boats or whatever. And, but at this point we have not been able to convince the Minister of Forestry that we're not going to cut any new trees down. We just want to actually export the wood that's just laying around serving no purpose. And it's difficult, you know, because if you're, don't see the value of it, it seems they find it hard to believe that that's actually what we're trying to do.
It's a trust issue.
And so they feel it's a trust issue. Exactly. So they feel like, because it's happened so much in the past that, you know, somebody, you get a license to export teak and, you know, next thing you know, you're paying guys on the black market just to go in and cut down these, you know, protected teak trees. So, that was something that's been pretty, it's been challenging, and we have not arrived at the solution yet, but it is kind of interesting that just, you know, whatever we don't have is exotic to us, right? Mm-hmm. So teak is exotic here. Mm-hmm. Oak is exotic in Asia. And so because reclaimed wood isn't very popular in some of these Asian countries, some of the Asian countries, it's extremely popular, but you know, they find it hard to believe that, well, that doesn't make sense. It's almost like somebody coming over here saying, hey, can I start buying your firewood and exporting it? Like, well, why would you do that? It's not worth it. And so it's just been kind of an interesting dynamic, dealing with international cultures and languages and all that kind of stuff. So,
well, it's going to be good that they don't value it that much, because the cost of shipping has got to be something that's to be factored in.
Yeah, it's, you know, shipping is definitely something that has to be factored in the whole economic equation for sure. However, it's pretty staggering how inexpensive it is to ship a 40-foot land and sea container. It's actually about half the cost that to ship a full semi-load from Kentucky to, say, Los Angeles is twice as expensive as it is to send a 40-foot land and sea container from Lexington, Kentucky to Ningbo, China, which does not seem like it's even possible, but that's just supply and demand, because there's so much being exported and imported on these, you know, huge cargo ships. That the price, so that fact is surprising to a lot of people, because it was to me when I first started this.
Okay. So how big is your warehouse?
So we have three different warehouses. One is about 30,000 square feet. One is 20,000 and the other is about 15. So we have about just shy of 60,000 square feet that we operate out of.
That lumber that you have, as a general rule, how fast do you turn it over? You know, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years?
Well, my accounting department continues to say, hey, we got to turn this over faster, which means we need more sales, bigger sales, all that kind of stuff. But I used to buy more inventory just to have so that whenever we needed it, we didn't have to go source it. Now we're functioning much more under a model of we buy it when we need it, because otherwise you just have so much cash tied up in inventory that's just sitting there that, yes, can be used at some point in time, but it just becomes very capital intensive. So we're trying to get much more to a buy as needed, because we now have the contacts,
right,
and the suppliers that can basically find it in a day or two, depending on what it is.
And you may have different people that have torn down barns and stuff, and they've kind of got it in their lot. You can just reach out to them and facilitate that transaction when necessary.
That's correct. So,
I mean, do you know what?
No, just a lot of them do have the stock. And so it's easier to say, hey, we'll come buy a truckload of X, Y, or Z rather than just have them bring it in and us buy every day from them for that's not necessarily for a particular project.
Sure. So when you do get the wood in, are people having you like slice it up into slabs for them? And I know you make products like wood flooring products and things like that, but do you do like rough cut prep? Not that your cuts are rough, but they may want all that cut up in slabs before they get it. What kind of preparation methodologies do you offer?
Yeah, so we do everything from selling raw material to another company just like us, for example, in Colorado or Oregon or in the Northeast, all over California, Texas. But we also can do any stage of the process. So we can do, if you just want it kiln dried and metal detected, we can do that. If you want it kiln dry, metal detected, and straight edged and back planed. So there's a number of different ways that you can order product from us, and it ranges all the way from essentially as it comes off the barn, just palletized and loadable on a semi-truck, all the way to finished or pre-finished flooring or pre-finished wall accents as well. So, or furniture, we do sell quite a bit of semi-processed material to other furniture manufacturers. So that's really the niche that we serve, is more of a B2B. We do sell some retail, but that's our focus is mostly on wholesale large volume to other of component parts to other manufacturers is kind of a niche that we've kind of started to, well, over the last few years developed, and that's really one that works for us just because they're taking the volume that we need them to take.
You still sell to, say, the guy that's got his own shop, he makes furniture, he's just looking for wood and sourcing it. You'll sell to him as a business?
Correct. We will.
Okay.
We just don't really take kind of walk-in off the street people that just want to buy like one stick of wood. That's not really what we do. And because we have done that in the past, but the person looking for just that perfect mantle beam, you know, and say that mantle beam is going to be $500 or $800, whatever the case may be, they're going to find the mantle beam that is in the back row of the biggest stack of wood that is going to take 2 hours to get to it and two guys on a forklift. And as soon as we get it out, they're going to say, you know what? I probably need to think about this another few days. All right, thanks. And so we've rearranged our warehouse, and, you know, so we're just not set up for retail. And so we prefer to sell to the people that are selling retail.
So I took a look at your website. I won't say in depth because I'll be honest, but I did review your different pages and things. It looks like you have kind of examples of your inventory, but you don't have like a specific inventory list that people could just go through and say, yeah, I'll take this, I'll take this, I'll take that. When somebody does need something, they just contact you and say, this is what we're looking for. Do you have it?
Yeah, correct. So for example, this morning, somebody, or actually last night, I didn't get until this morning, But the builder architect in New Zealand reached out and said, "Hey, I need these beams. You know, can you give me a price on these?" And he gave me the cut sheet. And I said, in this particular case, we actually have everything that he needs. And so I sent him back a, but so we don't really have a standing inventory. I mean, we do have an internal inventory list of everything that we have. But as far as advertising what we have, there's really just too many categories to put that out there. But if somebody reaches out to us, we can tell you, hey, this is what we have, or okay, we might have half of what you need, but you know, within a couple of days we could get the balance or whatever the case may be.
Okay. What's the largest piece of wood you've ever had to work with or had the privilege of working with?
We actually had a 1,000-year-old olive wood stump that was about 6.5 feet in diameter that we slabbed up into basically huge round cookies that people have made. That was probably the oldest tree. The biggest one we've had, actually the biggest timber we probably ever had was a wine press beam from Austria, and it was about just shy of 20 inches by 20 inches by about 17 feet. And that wasn't just a raw piece. I mean, it was actually hand cut. It's probably a 250-year-old wine press beam that, and so that was, and we actually just sold that to a customer in Montana. So those are two that pop out as two of the more interesting pieces we've ever had.
I would love to be able to, not that I'd want to live there for sure, but I'd love to be able to travel back 400 years ago and look at the trees and the way this country looked before we started cutting everything down.
It is pretty interesting to look at. I mean, since the 50s, actually, the forests are coming back in a huge way here in the United States. But, you know, there for, I don't know, 70 or 80 years, we were not being great stewards as a country, just because, there wasn't the communication and the knowledge that there is now. But, you know, back when the country was first sort of being discovered, if you look at a map of the trees, a squirrel, you know, could have never hit the ground from, you know, New England to parts of Texas. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of staggering to think about that, because now you see all these open fields and farmland and whatnot, but that was not always the case. It was just full of timber. And that's why a lot of the people, the value of coming to the New World, right, was a lot of that was
the resources.
Most people don't know is actually timber. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you're back in the old country, the old world, you did not have the right. If you cut down a tree, you were committing a crime, because that was not allowed. You could scrounge like twigs and branches that had fallen, but the land was owned by, you know, the lords, and you're pretty much just a squatter. I don't know, maybe a sharecropper, whatever you're going to call it, but you didn't have the ability to actually own land because it was just so limited. And eventually we'll get there here.
Yeah. It's one of the interesting stories that I've actually seen some of these trees, but you know, the King of England, would actually send surveyors over here to the new world, and trees that met a certain specification and species, the surveyors would brand that tree, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the people that actually lived here, you know, the pioneers and the first settlers, if they were to cut down one of those trees, it was, to your point, treason.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would actually, you know, send these surveyors, and then they had some police power as well. But a lot of them actually ended up getting sort of tarred and feathered.
Mm-hmm.
Because
or dead.
The people were like, look, or dead, you know, you can't come over here and tell me I can't like use this tree for lumber or whatever. And so that, you know, was part of the many reasons why eventually the war was fought. But I've actually seen some of those trees that actually have the king's stamp on them from England, that a lot of them have actually been recovered, like river recovered timber, because you know they're you know 200-300 years old, some of them. But it's kind of interesting, just fact that a lot of people don't know about, that actually timber was like one of the biggest resources that people were fighting over hundreds of years ago.
Absolutely. And that's pretty cool that you saw that real example. Thinking about the river makes me think of what they call bog. Have you ever messed with any of the wood that they recover that's been underwater for, no, I don't know, 100, 200, 300 years?
Yeah, so that's some of the stuff that I was doing in Nicaragua was the river recovered timber. And then the bog is a little bit different because that's actually wood that, you know, it's been under not water, but it's actually been under the ground. But it's preserved the same way, and in a lot of it's some of it's kind of petrification happens. But yeah, this is but they're both sort of along the same lines that you can wood has been preserved in a way that it would not have been preserved if it wouldn't have been outside those elements. For example, the river reclaimed stuff is the trees. You know, that's how they transported cut timber back before they had the ability. It was just. You cut at the trees, you rolled them into the river, and they floated down, then you put them on barges. But a lot of the biggest, densest trees would actually just sink to the bottom. And so they would, you know, bob along the bottom until they finally got lodged in the dirt. And where there was one tree, or one log, there's typically hundreds.
No way.
And so, yeah. And so some of these, I mean, it was really, that was one of the coolest things I've done is, you know, going around these forests deep in the heart of Central America where, you know, no one speaks English, no one looks like me, and actually being taken to these areas.
Oh, that sounds freaking cool.
the indigenous people were like, oh, I don't know why you guys like this, but if you want to know where they are, we know where they are. And they being these hundreds of like massive logs that are just lodged in the bottom of these rivers, you know, say 20 or 30 feet below the surface. So the oxygen content is so low that they don't actually rot. And they just, that's where they've been for a couple hundred years. And because of that they're underwater and the sediment and the minerals are just, you know, flowing over them for centuries, they have all these different colors in the wood. Even when you cut deep into the wood, that's just pretty staggering. And so, but it's very difficult to get them out. It's not physically, but by the time you deal with all the different layers of, the local tribes people, and then the regional people, and then the Nicaraguan government, and then, you know, it's a pretty difficult, it was overwhelming to be honest, but it was really fascinating. And to see the amount the sheer volume of wood that's there that nobody can see with your naked eye.
Yeah.
But it's there just below the surface. It's pretty crazy.
That is pretty cool. So let's take a little bit of a turn here. One of the things I read about is that you've got a unique aspect to some of your workforce. I'd like you to talk about that and, you know, tell me about this particular program.
Sure. So one of the things that, well, our tagline at Old World Timber is reclaim, redeem, and repurpose. And we're trying to do that with wood as well as, and perhaps much more importantly, in our own lives. And so a lot of my employees are guys that are coming from backgrounds of either addiction of some sort, a lot of challenges that come along with addiction, and then quite a few of them actually have served time in prison and have been released. Either they've served out their time or because they had a job offer from Old World Timber, they've actually been granted parole. And so we have had an opportunity and privilege really to kind of have a chance to show, hopefully be some small inspiration to other businesses to give guys that have a criminal background a chance to those that have paid their debts to society to actually, you know, not continue to be punished for the rest of their lives because they have a felony.
Right.
But at the same time, be able to get back on their feet, have a job, have a life, have a place, you know, have a family, have all the things that all of us want. Right. And so that's been become very much part of our DNA the last number of years. And it's something that definitely comes with some challenges, but, the benefits far outweigh any of the challenges that we've had, and it's something that I'm really proud of, and that our team is really passionate about. So,
That's very cool. And it takes a leap of faith to actually to do what you're doing there.
Yeah, I mean, it actually started, I mean, people have the sometimes misperception that I had this grandiose vision of, you know, reclaiming wood, reclaiming people, all this kind of stuff. And it's not that I would like to think that I'm a pretty compassionate person, but I really was finding it very difficult to find a consistent quality labor force. And so one of my, actually our company CFO, who's a advisor and mentor to me as well, he said, well, you know, how do you feel about guys with criminal backgrounds? And, you know, I thought about it and I said, well, you know, I'm a person of faith. I said, you know, God gave me a second chance. I think everybody deserves a second chance. So yeah, you know, let's see what that might look like. And that kind of opened up this door to, you know, to this, kind of redemption part of, us being able to offer employment to people who otherwise are finding it very difficult to find employment. And a few years ago, about 4 years ago, the state of Kentucky actually approached me to see if I would be willing to partner with an entity called Kentucky Correctional Industries, which is basically an industry inside the prisons that teaches these guys how to have a skill set, have a trade, so that they are equipped to find work when they get out. And so we've been working with them over the last 3 or 4 years, and it sort of ebbs and flows, but anywhere from, you know, 10 to 40 something guys that work on projects for Old World Timber on the inside through the Department of it's called Kentucky Correctional Industries. So we don't employ them directly. We just basically offer. I mean, we provide the services and products for them to make that then we buy back from them, or others buy from Kentucky Correctional Industries. So that's been a neat program, and we've had several guys come out of that program that did a great job on the inside, and then once they got out, they had a job waiting for them the day that they were released. So
that's awesome. And when you do the buyback, is that it like kind of like a fair market value, or is it a reduced?
Yeah. So, well, it's not actually. So we provide like the, you know, we'll send the wood, we'll send the equipment. In some cases, we'll send the materials, and so basically, Kentucky Correctional Industries is providing the labor, and Kentucky Correctional Industries bills us directly, so we don't actually pay the inmates. But you know, they're making less than a minimum wage, but they are making whatever it is, a few bucks an hour. But on the inside economy, they are the guys that are able to send money home to their families. They're the guys that don't have to sit in their cell. They, you know, they're actually working 8 or 10 hours a day in the very nice facilities that they have. And so it's something that people like, sometimes people in the past have said, oh my gosh, I heard you guys are using prison labor. It's like, well, hold on, let me tell you a little bit about what that really means. And then they come to the plant.
It's kind of an apprenticeship program as well.
Exactly. It's called the apprenticeship program. That's exactly the term that they have. There's the, a journeyman part of it that some of these guys are able to get a certificate for. It's sort of a step one to a electrical license or a plumbing license or a carpentry license. You know, so there's HVAC. There's all these different things, because most people don't understand that nationwide, that in 5 years, 85% of all inmates will be released. And so, you know, these guys, they're going to be in our society. So we really need to do a better job of helping them reenter and to reduce recidivism. Because if we're just, I mean, it costs about 30 grand a year per, you know, out of your and my tax dollars to house these guys. So isn't it better to equip these guys to be able to work and have a life and have dignity and provide for themselves when they get out by having a trade?
Right.
And if they don't have one, to learn on the inside, actually something that they can do for a living. So we're excited to be a part of that. And it's definitely been a journey, but we feel like we can't save the whole world, but to the extent we can make a difference in the lives of the employees that are working here.
Yeah.
We're excited to be a part of that. So
have you had anybody that you put to work and employed, and due to the fact that they had a good work history with you, that was able to allow them to step off to something even better? I'm not trying to, diss your company. I'm saying as they move up in
That's a great question. And that's something that I tell people when they first start working here. I said, look, you know, we expect you to respect other people, to work hard and to have a good attitude. But I want everybody here, including, you know, my director of operations all the way down to the guy that we just hired, you know, a couple weeks ago. If you ever get an opportunity, that is better for you and your family, and as long as you're fair with this company, you will not have a bigger advocate than me and you doing whatever that is. And we've had guys that have reconciled with family, felt terrible about giving their notice, but I said, man, that's what we're about, man. We're about reconciliation and redemption. And if you got the, you know, if you got another job in another state that you can be closer to your family, which you've been estranged from for 10 or 15 years because of this, the prison situation, you know, that's something we absolutely want to support. And so, I mean, you asked the question and a lot of people are like, that's 100% what we're about is helping people to continue to develop and improve. And,
right.
And if Old World Timber can be a stepping stone to that, that's something I am really proud of and will always be proud of and encouraging the guys to continue to develop for themselves and their families. So
I could see how somebody, as all hypothetical, could work for you for a year doing a great job and have established himself. And that provides the trust necessary for the family to say, okay, yeah, it looks like you really have changed your life and we're willing to talk to you again.
Correct. Because, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, there's a reason why they ended up in prison. And although, not to get on a soapbox, but, you know, for them, a lot of guys are doing time for things that are now legal.
Yes.
In, like, I don't know, 35 states.
Yes. So, it's ridiculous.
That's a little bit hard to get your mind around and seems like that's, but anyways, the, you know, the families are looking for, you know, these guys are their husbands, their fathers, their brothers, their sons, you know, and so there's a whole family, there's a whole community that needs to be kind of restored. And if we can provide the economic or a piece of the whole puzzle by having them be able to make a living and have some dignity and walk a little taller and be proud of what they're doing, that does help with the family. And, you know, we hope, like I said, we can't change the whole world, but we hope to be able to be a small inspiration to other businesses and other companies to give these guys a chance and not just have this strict, you know, if you have a criminal background, you know, we throw your application in the trash. Because as a society, if we say, hey, this is the penalty for whatever you did, the mistake you made, once you've served your time or the parole board has seen fit because of your behavior, because of your good conduct to grant you parole, I think we should have grace for these people as it relates to being able to be employed. Because if they can't find a job, they can't make a living, well, they just go back to doing whatever they had to do to survive, which in many cases puts them back in prison, which is defeats like the purpose of society is supposed to be about, right? So.
Okay. Well, that's very cool. What is the most satisfying aspect to you about your whole Old World Timber business and infrastructure that you've built?
In my opinion, the most satisfaction that I glean is doing something creative and artistic, which is what we're doing with the wood, and also making a difference in people's lives. That's something that I hope and pray that we're doing every day. But when I see some successes and evidence that is working, it really does keep me going. It doesn't take much, but when I see somebody, you know, reconcile with a family member, or one of our guys buy a house, you know, that has been in prison for 27 years and now he's back on his feet. He's been working for us for a couple years and now he's buying his first house ever. And he never thought in a million years that he'd be able to do that. Things like that are really, really what encourage me and keep me just fighting every day.
That's awesome. So where do you see Old World Timber going in the future? Maybe not like necessarily a year, but like just kind of project it out a ways.
Yeah, I think we're at a critical or tipping point where we are now large enough to where we're getting cracks at doing larger projects, which is what we need because what we really need, what any big manufacturing, or I mean, not, we're not big, but any manufacturing company needs is consistent monthly orders from customers that we refer to as legacy customers, customers that just order every month. And it's not something that we have to go out and find a brand new customer for every single month.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's probably a strategic partnership that's coming in the near to medium term with some bigger companies, whether it's a, well, I'll leave it at that, but just so that we're able to really scale in a way that we wouldn't be able to do if it was just me like it is right now. So there's some scalability that I would like to be able to take advantage of. And I'm going to probably forming a strategic partnership in some way with another entity in order to do that best.
All right. Sounds great. Well, we're going to wrap this up shortly, but other than Old World Timber, what are like some of your interests and passions?
Yeah. So I love, I'm a really active person. I love mountain biking. I still play quite a bit of sports and I love the outdoors and I love really being with my family. I have a 4-year-old and a 3-year-old and my wife and I love being with our kids. They love coming over to the shop and running around and cutting on their, you know, using their little toys to cut on the wood. But we love to travel as well. And my wife and I have been able to go to different. She's actually been able to come with me to a lot of, on the sourcing trips, which is a lot of fun, and to do kind of a vacation that's business at the same time when we go to these crazy places looking for wood. And then so I guess some of the other things that I do, one of the other companies I own is a craft bourbon distillery here in Kentucky. And I also own some real estate. And like I said, I like to stay pretty active and got my hands in a lot of different things. But Old World Timber is definitely where I spend the majority of my time and energy and passion.
Well, that's outstanding. Well, Nathan, I really appreciate you coming on the show today and sharing your business and your journey and kind of the aspect of your life. And it's an interesting story and some cool stuff that you're doing. And I look forward to swinging by and checking out your place when I finally get my road trip going.
Yeah, I think you'd get a kick out of seeing what we're doing here. It's pretty cool.
I'm looking forward to taking video and just, you know, bringing that to life for everybody.
Yeah, I think seeing it. Hearing about it's one thing, but you know, seeing a couple pictures or videos is kind of really something that most people find pretty interesting.
Well, Nathan, thank you so much, and we'll go ahead and wrap it up. I'll get this posted soon. I appreciate it.
All right, John. Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it, and I'll look forward to seeing what you come up with.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right.
On the next episode of Blue Collar Voices, we have Trent Hendricks of Cabrejo Ranch. Trent is working to raise sustainable, healthy meat and utilizing creative grazing as a part of his plan. Hear how he got started, what he is doing, and what he is working on in this edited snippet of my chat with Trent Hendricks.
There's nothing to sell.
That's right.
There's no tractors, trucks, corn, genetics. So vested interest in food and ag, they promote this and ride the wave. Realizing, you know, that at the end of the day, you know, they're giving away competitive advantage, or do they kind of restrict and say, "Ah, no, that's a bunch of horse pucky," and you know, this is the only way we're actually going to feed, you know, the population in 2050 when it hits whatever the number is. And you know, again, it's what is truth. You have to look. It's the old adage, "Follow the money," and the truth changes with those interests typically. Not that I have any opinion.
Hey guys, before you go, two things. The first is, I'm looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show. Basically, I'm looking for those that excel in the blue collar arena and have actually got their hands dirty, truly understanding what it is like to do the work. I realize this is an older podcast, but I'm updating this podcast in November 2019 for the announcement of an upcoming road trip. Phase one is building a list of locations to visit. Some locations will be just a meet and greet. Others will be on-site audio and or video. Please check out the website for more information. I'd love to hear from you.
email me at johnc@bluecollarvoices.com. You can also hit me up on LinkedIn. Thanks all. Looking forward to hearing from you. Blue Collar Voices is produced by John Chapman, and all audio, video, graphics are created and edited by John Chapman. Blue Collar Voices is a DR7 Media production.
I'll be back.